I come back from England from being in a psychedelic light show. And now I was broke and did not have a job or anything. And I'm living at home with my mother. This is a low point. I'm about 24 and I had nothing to do all day. So I was just drive around and listen to FM radio. I'm listening to Scott Muni, and I've got about $30 in the world. So I'm living off my mom. And Scott says, I've got some new records to play and I want to play this guy. The album's called Greetings from Asbury Park and his name is Bruce Springsteen and he plays Blinded by the Light. Immediately caught me. I'm not that far from the Bergen Mall. And so I go say to myself, I'm just going to go there to look at the cover. Just going to look at the cover. So I give away like 18% of my life savings at that point.
Welcome to Discography, the podcast that gives Gen X music maniacs a chance to smell like teen spirit again by connecting with a brotherhood obsessed with rating the entire discography of every single artist and band that ever mattered. I'm your host, Dave Gebro, and with three new episodes each week, you're going to gain a comprehensive knowledge of an act's history and output in the time it takes to listen to one album. In this episode, we'll be turning our spray cans on Alan Arkush, director of Rock and Roll High School, Get Crazy, Shake, Rattle, and Rock, Elvis Meets Nixon, and The Temptations. Tonight's episode is a passionate rundown of the man's 10 favorite albums of all time. In addition, throughout the summer, we'll also be dropping a crucial Patreon series called Fillmore Feast, in which Alan covers his time under the employ of Bill Graham as he rose through the ranks at the Fillmore East, doing practically every single job imaginable there, and wound up hanging, partying, getting dosed by, and becoming tight friends with the Dead, the Allmans, and all the rest of the legends of the day. Look, if you know, then you know. But if you don't, then you ain't going nowhere, because right this second, finally, is your chance to stop embarrassing yourself around friends you give a shit about when the subject of Alan Arkush's 10 favorite albums of all time comes up, as it often does. Tonight's guest is one of the greatest filmmakers of our day, and for our purposes, the depth of his knowledge of and passion for music has given birth to several of the greatest films about music ever made. Alan Arkush is a legend. In this episode of Discography, Alan reveals the 1966 concert that forever changed his life, our votes for the most indispensable box set of all time, and why it took him a while to get the Ramones. Okay, first things first, you need to know just how seriously I take this craziness. Although this episode's an interview about his top 10 records, the typical episode is a music obsessive's dream come true. The guest and I explore their favorite band's entire discography in a futile but valiant attempt to reach a higher truth, which often is cleverly disguised as a nerdy compendium of star ratings and lists. The show is heavily researched, and the music is always reassessed with fresh ears. We don't just cover albums. We do a searingly honest deep dive analysis of all EPs, singles, comp tracks, relevant solo work, and sometimes bootlegs and live stuff. Every release is slapped with an objectively accurate star rating between 0 and 5, which allows us all, the real reason we do this, the Tootsie Pop reward at the center of the rock and roll lolly, to come face to face with the true shape of an artist's overall arc. Coming up, we've also got Jennifer Harima from Royal Trucks rating the New York fucking Dolls, Will Oldham, both Vashti Bunyan and The Association rating the entirety of their own output, and Anthony Fantano, The Origin Story. So don't miss out. Open up your listening app right now and subscribe. Really, do it. And away we go then with Alan Arkush, fellow New Jersey Jew, as we learn about what happens when a man is split in two over a shared love of film and music, and how he comes to reconcile these two twin passions. Our guest this evening is a renowned film director known for his works in the music industry and comedy film. However, before his success in the film industry, he led quite the interesting life filled with various experiences that shaped him into the artist he is today. Music and movies, music and movies, music and movies is what my brain and his brain repeats on a loop from the second we wake up until the second we go beddy bye. Lads and ladies out in the twilight reaches of the eternal Fillmore, way, way up there in the 27 Club reaches of heaven, Alan Arkush.
That is quite an intro. I keep thinking, who is he talking about?
Typically self-effacing, right?
Yeah.
I'm so psyched about this because you're one of the most passionate, nerdy music fans that I've had on the show, and I've had quite a lot.
Yeah. I think that that's your lingua franca.
Yeah. I mean, your YouTube channel, you're like tripping over yourself explaining this stuff. I think if you didn't even have an audience for it, you would still do it. Like me, you can't help yourself, right?
Right. Yeah. And also, I've directed and produced like 400 TV shows and movies. And at a certain point in my life, I just got sick of people giving me notes or doing other people's material, etc. And look, I'm not complaining. I had a great career doing that. But once Trailers from Hell happened, Joe Dante's, it's for movie historians and movie fun people, you talk about different movies. I felt this freedom again because Joe lets you talk about any movie. And so from there, it fits in perfectly here. So it's the 50th anniversary of the Fillmore East. I worked there from the summer of 68 till it closed. And this is while I was at NYU. They wanted me to do a little hello, you know, on video. I started to do that. And then I thought, I'm just going to talk about my favorite shows. Because my point was, you know, Thomas Wolfe says you can't go home again. But you know what? You and me and all of you out there, we can. Just put on the live album from your days when you want to hear it and put on your headphones and it will take you back. So I basically did a compendium of the live records and made joking reviews of every kind of concert. Couple people got put down. I'm not going to name names, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, but other people got the praise that they needed. So I sent it to them and they never used it. So now I got this 10-minute thing, 12-minute thing. So I put it on my Facebook page. 7,000 hits. Everyone's saying, do another, do another. So I did one on The Who. I ended up doing my autobiography that way. When Marty Balin passed away, I told my experiences with him, etc. So that's a real fun way for me to communicate all this. And I guess that's where you heard some of what I'm talking about.
Definitely birds of a feather. The music and film thing is really the core of my entire being. It's always been, some people have the angel and the devil. I've got music and film. I mean, I'm an avid reader too, but music and film really were the two poles. Right. Let's talk about your favorite albums of all time. Let's start with the doo-wop box set. If you're looking for an echo, where do you find it? Where would it be? The Flamingos? What song would be the starting point? If somebody has never heard doo-wop before, where do you start?
Oh, if someone has never heard doo-wop, In the Still of the Night.
Is that your favorite?
I would do that, or Dion and the Belmonts, or Little Anthony Imperials, Tears on My Pillow. The thing about them is that I used to lie in bed at night and listen to Murray the K and the Swinging Soiree, which was a local show, and Murray played a lot of doo-wop. And it was a window into a world that I did not know. I was a middle-class Jewish kid. And these sounds of these beautiful voices, some of which were experiencing pain, some were experiencing longing, and they took me into their world. I loved it, you know. It was a trip, and Murray played it each night like it was. And, you know, here rock and roll was only 5 years old or so, because I am about 8 or 10 years old. And every Saturday night, they had a contest for the greatest oldie of all time. Oldie? They were 5 years old. You know, 16 Candles, Daddy's Home, You're 1,000 Miles Away, you know, all that stuff. I used to love listening to that stuff. And then, thank God that they put out that box doo-wop set, because it gave me a lot of stuff. And now there was 3 volumes. So I didn't have to chase down the 45s eventually. And Murray the K had a not just the big shows that he did at the Brooklyn Paramount every year. Murray had his own language called Mia Surrey, and he was very friendly with the musicians. His biggest thing is he became the fifth Beatle.
I know he also helped give people context at your Forest Hills Bob Dylan show, which we'll get to, of course.
Right. And so he put on a show at the Fort Lee Jewish Community Center. That is, he brought like 4 or 5 groups and they lip synced, and the show was like an hour, and then he'd move on to another Jewish community center, and he'd do like four or five of these. And I come in, I have never seen African Americans, certainly as a group. And I'm hanging out because I'm comfortable. It's my temple. And these guys, the way they talk to each other and the jokingness and the sort of ease that was completely unlike any adult I had ever seen. And I'm hanging on the side watching them, and they're having fun making fun of other bands, that is, other groups. They're imitating them. And then Gene Chandler comes up on the stage, and he's wearing a cape and a top hat, and he sings Duke of Earl, and that was it. I went, I love this world. So that's how that happened. And there was a direct line between that experience and my miniseries, The Temptations.
Now, the Gene Chandler show, that's your first live show of all time ever, right?
Yes. And it wasn't live because it was playback, you know.
Right, right. Which I didn't even know that they were doing lip sync stuff back then.
Well, that's what they do. They just play the record and the guys would lip sync along with it. Then they didn't have to bring any equipment.
Did they have sort of Motown-y moves, or were they just kind of standing there?
They had organic moves to what they were doing. They didn't really do many moves. This is like early, because it wasn't until 61, I'm going to guess, or 60, that I heard Shop Around on the radio. When I heard Shop Around, I went, holy, this is unbelievable.
I have a great trivia question for you about Smokey. Smokey has said that there's only one song he's written that's autobiographical. Do you know the song?
Ooh, Tracks of My Tears?
More Love.
Ah, okay.
The reason is because Claudette had miscarried and it was a song for her.
Oh, okay.
It's interesting because, you know, Dylan refers to him as, you know, the, I'm paraphrasing,
greatest poet, which is one of the all-time, I mean, folks, if you can go on YouTube and look up Bob Dylan press conference, and you will see one of the funniest press conferences, because in those days, there was a couple of people who knew how to turn the press on their ears. John Lennon and the Beatles were masters at it, and Bob Dylan showed them the door on this one.
Well, Dylan had his own way of making everybody who crossed his path feel like an idiot.
When somebody asked him in the audience, Dylan says, no, I'm a song and dance man. And the guy doesn't look up. He says, you're a protest singer. How many protest singers are there? And there's this pause, and Dylan says, 35. Yeah, it says 35. He says, no, I'm sorry. There's 37.
One more thing before we move past the sure. Doo-wop box. Anyone who's, you know, only has a vague familiarity with doo-wop is that the song on that box that they say is the origin of doo-wop is a song I had never heard before that box, which I really fell in love with. The Orioles, It's Too Soon to Know. From 1948.
Yeah, that really is. That's like 53 or 52, something
48,
like that.
48, actually. 48, wow. Yeah, yeah. It's got like a woozy displacement to it that almost feels like the original version of Sea of Love, where it almost feels like you need drama. Yeah. So beautiful.
We got a lot of fans here who know doo-wop. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Really interesting recordings that are like the history of doo-wop in one song. One is by the Persuasions, where they do the riffs and they segue from one to the other. And the other is by the Belmonts. And it's the album which has a candy store on the cover. And they basically go through all their favorite riffs. And they're wonderful. The last cut is like 8 minutes long from riff to riff. And it's just their voices. And it's so thrilling to hear them do that.
It's a great music form. And yeah. It's also the first moment where I realized I was getting older, because my dad would always be playing CBS FM 101.1, and it was always doo-wop. And then one day, oldies was Billy Joel.
Talk about being older. I was in Toronto, I think it was, doing a TV movie in like 2000, and they assigned me a PA. The PA would drive me to and from, you know, the set and wherever I wanted. And if you're in the car with me, you got to listen to what I'm listening to. There's no discussion. And finally, she doesn't know any of this. And finally, she says to me, why are all these people doing that tick, 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 bomb, 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 those sounds? And I said, you've never heard this? No, I never heard any of this. She's like 22 or something.
Yeah.
And I said, because they don't have instruments.
Right.
Those sounds are their backing music. And she goes,
Yeah, and interestingly, you know, because they don't have instruments, the vocal sounds they were using were the hard consonants to get that hit. Like, you know, Blue Moon is not, it's bomb, 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 bomb. You know, it's like a bass drum almost.
Oh, listen, to be able to recreate in Shake, Rattle, and Rock, a version of Blue Moon was so much fun.
In the John Candy movie, Going Berserk, he's out in the jungle somewhere and he's teaching these Aboriginal people how to do the Marcel's arrangement of Blue Moon. Yeah. It's so funny. All right, so your favorite Dylan record, I've heard you say Blood on the Tracks, I've heard you say Highway 61. Which is it, for Christ's sake?
Okay, it's really tough because
I got to go with Blood on the Tracks.
Okay. The first one I heard that I owned was Times They Are Changing. And it served a real function for my early teenage anger and self-righteousness. But then when I heard Freewheeling and Blowing in the Wind was on the radio with Peter, Paul, and Mary, that, you know, carried me away. And then for my birthday, when I turned 18, my parents brought me Bringing It All Back Home, which I played to death. Oh, everything about it, you know.
Yeah.
And at the end of that summer, Bob Dylan was going out on tour and was going to play at the Forest Hills Tennis Stadium. We had seen folk music because there was a folk show that was on every Tuesday night from Palisades Amusement Park, which was a middle class and lower class in the sense it was very, as blue collar amusement park. It's not like Disneyland. You paid a quarter to get in.
This was, of course, Chuck Barris's greatest contribution culturally.
Yes. And so every Tuesday night they had the Jerry White folk show, which was from there. And that's where I saw all the people that were coming out of the folk scene, and Dave Van Ronk and Jesse Colin Young, the Simon sisters, that's Carly and her sister, you know, and all these people. And so now we wanted to go see a concert, a Dylan concert, and we each ponied up $5. Now, for $5, we figured we'd be sitting on the stage. And so we go all the way out to Forest Hills. And remember, there's no rock press, so we have no idea what had just happened at Newport. And as he's singing the folk songs, he's singing mostly the recent stuff that he's doing. There's acoustic. It's not fair to say folk. Acoustic stuff. And by the way, he was introduced by Jerry White from the folk show that we used to go to. So everything is okay, you know.
Right.
And Desolation Row was not exactly going over and so forth. Then he finishes. And at that point, he says, we'll be back in 10 minutes. That's the first time I ever bought a beer. He comes back. There's these guys plugging in instruments behind him. And Murray the K comes out. He's wearing a bright red suit, which is not folk. And he goes, we're having a big night tonight, and I want to introduce Bia Zabi Dia Zillin, which is like an insult. And they go into Maggie's Farm, and the audience is shocked. They're holding their ears. It's not very loud, but they're holding their ears. And he played an electric set. And he tore it up. But when he sings It Ain't Me, Babe, Electric, the audience is going, no, 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 no. People are rushing the stage. It was such tension in the audience. I didn't know whether I liked it or not because I was confused. I'm not a complete human being yet. I'm 17 years old and I'm with my best friends. He sings this. He says, this is the song for all of you people out there with that kind of pointedness.
Right. Yeah.
He's saying something's happening here and you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones? And now the place gets quiet because it's like, what's he singing about? And he sings the lines about, you've been through all of F. Scott Fitzgerald's books. It's clear he's talking about college people. And my friend Dennis turns to me and goes, he totally nailed us. And there's applause and they go off and he comes back on and plays Like a Rolling Stone. It was thrilling.
Is that your favorite song of all time?
That's my favorite song. And about a week later, I bought Highway 61 Revisited.
This show happened a week or two before that record even came out.
Exactly. Yeah. This was a tour to promote that record.
Right.
That was a night to remember. We were, when we took the subway back from Queens and we got to the Port Authority in New York, we realized that we had spent the money on beer beer. We had no way to get home. So we decided to walk across the George Washington Bridge. It's a special night, you know, in our lives. We knew we had seen something that we would never forget. And we get to the middle of the bridge, and we're looking out, and the moon is shining on the Hudson, you know, and from the bridge, you can see all the way down to the bottom of Manhattan on that night. My friend Susan says, how much money do we have? Who's got money? And we got like 2 dimes. She goes, give it to me. And it says, everybody make a wish. And she tosses the dimes off the bridge. And we're all leaning, watching these dimes go down. And it's like that Dylan song about being with friends again. I wish I could ride with them again. You know.
I dreamed a dream that made me sad concerning myself.
Yes, that's it.
Yeah, yeah. I got a question for you because, you know, that story, when I heard you talk about it on your YouTube channel, it seemed like just the way you were talking about it, you had, like any good filmmaker, found the perfect way to tell the story, which, as we all know, of course, pulls the emotion out of it because you found the best way to tell the story. But that moment, I could tell, could be a contender for the most meaningful moment of your entire life. So my question is, how did you avoid marrying Susan Miller?
Susan and I became really, really close friends, you know, and we stayed that way. Her and my friend Dennis Benson, we rode the cultural waves together, you know. Yeah. We did everything together. When we met and the Stones are playing and she told me how much she liked the Stones, I had never actually talked to a girl my age who said they liked the Rolling Stones or had that conversation. She told me, oh, you got to buy Out of Our Heads. Who are you? You know, and I used to go over her house and listen to the Dylan albums I didn't have. She was really well read. She ended up going to Bennington and I drove her up there for her interview. I'm still friendly with her. I still talk to her.
You sent me a picture of the four of you went to lunch recently, right?
Yeah, a couple years ago, yeah.
What a wonderful thing to have.
Say one more thing about Dylan. I love Blood on the Tracks, but what I love even more is More Blood, More Tracks.
Oh yeah.
Is so brilliant.
How about that one moment where Mick Jagger's in the fucking studio, which I had no idea. That's the moment I remember from the soundtrack, because he lays some kind of instrument on or gives Dylan a suggestion, and it's so not right. It's so way off being right. But Dylan does it anyway because it's Mick Jagger recommending it. Yeah.
The versions of those songs, it's a great box set.
It really is. If you had to say the most indispensable box set of all time, I know what mine is. It would be the Genuine Basement Tapes.
Okay, that's a tough one. I could joke and say the Europe 72 box because you never get tired of it. There's so much music.
Yeah, yeah. That's the last time Pigpen had things to offer.
If I want to be provocative, I'm going to say Nuggets.
Yeah, sure.
It can vary. I got the doo-wop boxes there. There's a Who box that I really love. You know, there's a Ray Charles, Genius of Soul.
Oh, that one's amazing.
The first Birds box set I love dearly. They did two of them. The second one's not as good. You know, I love the Dylan box set. All the slightly different versions, and he gave notes on how he wrote it, and Blind Willie McTell was on it, and all this other stuff.
Yeah, that's Biograph.
That's it. That was kind of indispensable for a couple of years. I have to say also the Temptations box set, because I carried it with me everywhere when we made the movie.
Actually, a very close friend of mine was in your film. Ben Kane played one of the Temptations from the early 70s, I think.
Oh, okay.
Very close friend of mine.
He's probably in Papa Was a Rolling Stone then.
Yeah.
He's in those scenes, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the Dennis Edwards era. All right, so Richard Thompson, Shoot Out the Lights. Another great pick and another great example of marital strife on record.
Yes. The Richard Thompson record has such great reverberations. Shoot Out the Lights is a song that the pain in the guitar playing matches the pain of the lyrics. The Wall of Death, which is an uplifting song about dying.
Linda's singing is heartbreaking on the record, especially to me, Walking on a Wire.
Yes, Walking on a Wire is brilliant. And I've heard an even better version of it. It's on Linda Thompson's Greatest Hits or something. And we tried to get it for Crossing Jordan to put on the show, but she controls it and she wasn't interested. And I think that version is too painful. It's so nakedly emotional.
From a distant view, their marriage did not sound like a barrel of monkeys.
No.
They were involved in some very ascetic spiritual approaches
That right.
did not sound like a hell of a lot of fun. I haven't heard those records yet, the Pour Down Like Silver and that kind of stuff.
Oh, I've got all of those, yeah. Because I had seen them in Fairport Convention.
Yeah, Fairport, I mean, yeah.
A lot of my music buying comes from connections between bands. And I'm a sucker, once I read Crawdaddy, I'm a sucker for music reviews from people that, whose taste I trust.
Yeah.
And so Robert Christgau is kind of responsible for quite a bit of my record. If he gave an album an A, I bought it. You know, I go to Tower Records and buy it. And I've still got that damn Pear Ubu record, and I still don't like it.
Great Waves? Yeah. You gotta give it another chance.
I've been given a lot of chances. Yeah. I will give bands chances. But I've got three Smashing Pumpkins albums I'd really like to unload.
Okay. Whoever recommended that to you was way off base. But yeah. I got to tell you, I don't even know how many years it took me to wrap my fucking mind around Trout Mask Replica and PIL Second Edition.
PIL is not for me. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
I have the vinyl on Trout Mask.
Nice. All right, Sticky Fingers. Do you think that's your favorite song?
To think of us to go with the Stones again, because I grew up with them.
As soon as Mick Taylor got in the group, they're interchangeably perfect.
Yes, and yet Let It Bleed.
You know what I really, really respected? And it's probably the only thing about the film, except for the final sequence, that's worth anything. But Antonioni Zabriskie Point, the fact that he used You Got the Silver, that's yeah. always been like a come from behind classic for me.
The intro to Get Off My Cloud, that drum break, and then Mick in the back goes, yeah, that's rock and roll to me. His yeah, and the clarity of Charlie's drums and the first chords of Brown Sugar on a good stereo. The whole intro and the song of Brown Sugar is rock and roll perfection. That combined with the variety of tunes and sounds and the quality of the playing. You got to move on that?
It is. And I Got the Blues. I Got the Blues is so good. And Moonlight Mile is a masterpiece.
Although one of my students in class took a track from, of all things, Tattoo You. And call a track called Heaven and put it on his film. And I went, oh, man, I love this song. So I've been playing Tattoo You over and over again. And as a record, in the context of time, it really holds up well.
You know why that is? There's a very, very specific reason for that. A good chunk of that record is Goat's Head Soup cast-offs.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it, even though it was released in 81, a lot of what you hear is kind of based in 73.
Right, and they had gone through every tape. The story I read somewhere or other is they were listening to all these reggae versions of Start Me Up. They get to the first take, and that's the version that we have, and they're going, why did we not think this was the right way? Because in context, they're going, oh, it's just another Stone song. We're looking for something else, you know? Yeah. And also, I have to say that Bob Clearmountain's mix on that record is all time. You listen to that on a good stereo or on headphones, the way the voices work in and out, and the song about a limousine, you know?
Yeah, black limousine.
That is the Stones as a blues band is perfect.
That's their last great record. I mean, I like everything they've done, except maybe Voodoo Lounge or Bridges to Babylon or whatever, but that's the last one where it's recognizably the Stones, I think. They never sounded better than under unbelievable duress December 6th, 1969 at Altamont. I think they never sounded filthier. Never sounded more legitimately demonic. Yeah. I've heard their whole set there. It's really tremendous.
Because I was at the concert in Madison Square Garden, the Yaya's.
Okay.
And I was at that concert with one of the women that Riff Randall is based on.
That's great. So as a Jersey boy who had big dreams and huge ambitions, Born to Run, did you connect with that on that level in addition to the music? Because I know for myself, being in high school, the Born to Run, Darkness, River trilogy was sort of this instrumental back of the mind soundtrack for getting the fuck out. And I think at this point in 75, maybe you're not driving a taxi, but you're not quite out yet, right?
Actually, we were shooting Hollywood Boulevard.
Okay.
And that was the album I was playing a lot. I come back from England from being in a psychedelic light show. And now I was broke and did not have a job or anything. And I'm living at home with my mother. This is a low point. I'm about 24 and I had nothing to do all day. So I would just drive around and listen to FM radio. I'm listening to Scott Muni. And I've got about $30 in the world. So I'm living off my mom. And Scott says, I've got some new records to play, and I want to play this guy. The album's called Greetings from Asbury Park, and his name is Bruce Springsteen, and he plays Blinded by the Light. Immediately caught me. Immediately. I'm not that far from the Bergen Mall. And so I go say to myself, I'm just going to go there to look at the cover. Just going to look at the cover. So I give away like 18% of my life savings at that point. I loved that record and did not like the second one. When I bought the third one and I heard Born to Run or Thunder Road.
Yeah.
I played that album to death. Knowing that John Landau produced it closed a circle in my life. Because when I discovered Crawdaddy in a record store, I was in college and blooming intellectually and finally getting a chance to critically analyze works of art. And then to see this magazine, and these people were taking music as seriously as I was taking Walt Whitman and T.S. Eliot. And when I read John Landau's stuff, it was not the collegiate aspects to a lot of what people were doing. And, you know, R. Meltzer was comparing Are You Experienced to cave paintings and so forth. His analytical sense of what made records work so impressed me. I wish, John, if you're listening to this, I've said this 100 times, I would love to meet you or talk to you because your critical sense and how you analyze stuff is a key to so much of my life. Okay.
Next. Are You Experienced? It's an interesting one to pick. I would go with Electric Ladyland. Tell me how that knocked your block off.
Okay. Summer of 67. There is so much good music on the radio. It's just crazy time. Sergeant Pepper. It's not music. It's Technicolor music. It's original Technicolor Imbivision music. All of a sudden, the radio starts making these sounds. And I'm thinking to myself, this guy, Jimi Hendrix, I know the name because I had been on the college radio station. Hey Joe is a single. And I thought, I will never understand this music. This music. Yeah. It's so far beyond comprehension of us human beings. But I bought that record and it all came into focus. It's a guide to how to make art. Here's my wrap on that, because I'm giving it to you like I tell my students. First off, I ask them if they ever heard of Jimi Hendrix.
There are people who say, no, I've never heard of him.
No, it's amazing how much music they have heard of because it's all available to them. And it mostly comes from parents or grandparents. And I said, okay, if Jimi Hendrix had just played the blues, he would have been known as a footnote in music history as an outstanding blues player. Because his blues reaches into your heart. You know, and grabs you. But as such, he's on a list of great blues guitarists. The other part of his music is Martian. It's like music from another planet. Those noises and the feedback and the tones he's using. But if he had just played Martian music, it again would be a footnote. But he wants you to understand his music. So he gives you something you can hang on to, the blues, and contextualizes the far out stuff and becomes one. And that's what you as young filmmakers have to do. If you want to take us somewhere with your ideas, you got to hold the door open for us.
Yeah.
And that sums up my feelings about Jimi Hendrix and his genius. Same thing with Miles Davis.
What's your favorite Miles record?
In a Silent Way.
Awesome stuff.
And the box set, a live box. There's something I didn't think about for my favorite box set. There's a live box set with him and the band, the Rest in Peace Wayne Shorter. Order.
So, Parliament, Mothership Connection.
That was of Christgau. I kind of knew who they were.
By the way, strong roots in doo-wop, Jersey doo-wop too.
Yes. I just want to testify. And this guy is talking to me like he's in the radio. And so, look, as a filmmaker, that's called breaking the fourth wall.
Right.
So I'm immediately intrigued. Plus, I think the rap is so funny. I want to get funked up.
You make the leap to hip hop then? Because this is kind of the groundwork for that. Or did it not really tickle your sensibilities as much as George?
Well, I loved that album because it was like a story. It was so funny. And yeah. So original. And these guys are dressed up like aliens. Plus, I go to the Tower Records. There's like 10 other records. So immediately I go, oh, my God, I've struck gold. The Brides of Frankenstein? Give me two. Bootsy Collins? I'll have one of those.
I like the water one. It's almost directly after Mothership Connection.
And all those songs, knee deep. I mean, all that stuff is great. When it came to hip hop, it was a sort of similar journey for me as punk rock, in the sense of I was not where it was happening. All the big music in my life was very close to me because I either saw it live or it was a part of it. Now, Chris Gow is writing about the Ramones. So I go out and buy the first Ramones record. This is off topic, but I think your fans want to know how I got into the Ramones.
Hey lads and ladies, Dave Gebro here. I abandoned my career and moved my family 3,000 miles to be able to focus exclusively on Discog Graffiti. And so if you're like me, and enough is just never enough, then please visit patreon.com/discograffiti and become one of our Patreon soldiers of sound. Discog Graffiti is an entirely listener-supported show, and it's also intended to be a 3 times a week music deep dive experience. So do us both a favor and consider giving it a shot. Trust me, I'm working hard for the money, so hard for it, honey. There's the main show on Friday, a Monday wildcard episode, which is either a soul-bearing interview with that week's special guest, or an offshoot show like Queasy Listening and Rock Cousteau. And then on Wednesdays, there's the humdinger of them all, Discog Graffiti's The Private Press with Paul Major. You got nothing to lose. If you don't dig it after a month, you're refunded. No questions asked. Once again, that's patreon.com/discograffiti.
And so I buy the first one and I put it on and I'm listening to it. And it was like, what is this? I know most records, it tends to sound alike the first time you listen to it, a Stones album especially. Listen to it again. I can't tell one song from another. It's all like a monotone to me. Nothing.
Which is interesting to me because of your love for girl groups. I would have thought you would have connected to it on that level.
So I have some friends come over, and at this time, I'm in the midst of New World Pictures big time. And so we were to watch movies every night in 16 millimeter, you know. And so Joe Dante's there, and John and everyone, John Davison and all the gang from New World, to watch a movie on 16. And they said, you got any good records? I said, you guys are just not going to believe this. I got to play this for you. I don't know whether it's a joke or whatever it is, but New York is crazy about this band. And I put on the Ramones. And then I go, now listen to this. And I skip through the whole record, cut by cut. And as I'm doing this, it hits me. It's supposed to be like this.
Right.
Oh, my God. And it really dawns on me, second verse, same as the first. Third verse, different than the first. And it's like, I go, wow. And so now I like the Ramones, you know, and making sense and being outside of the punk scene. That's why I'm getting to hip hop. I'm seeing it remote. And I think that all New York caught on to it because they were in it. Yeah. And because it's so different than anything else. So the second one was good. But when I put on Rocket to Russia, it's like, this is one of the 10 greatest records ever made. This is phenomenal. So when I was in that meeting where we were trying to find a band, and somebody at Warner Brothers says, do you know Sire Records? I go, yeah, I got all the Talking Head stuff. And they said, how about the Ramones? And I thought, wow. The Ramones sound to me, I realized at the time, especially with Rocket to Russia, they sound like a girl group or a surf band backed up by chainsaws. I love that idea.
Yeah.
It was just what I was looking for. I was trying to make a pop movie with a rock and roll edge.
Yeah. And, you know, interestingly, a lot of the punk, which was based on the idea of negation, these guys were not about kicking traditional music out of their bed. They were building on that foundation.
Yeah. And as I got to listen to more of stuff, I heard the Bay City Rollers in their music and so forth. And the more I got to know Joey, he would always play something for me at his apartment. The only one he played for me that didn't work was Kiss. The same thing with hip hop, you know, The Breaks, Curtis Blow.
Yeah, yeah.
The Fab Five.
Freddie.
Again, I was so distant from it where it was happening. Intellectually, it appealed to me until I heard the message. And once I heard the message, I went, oh, shit, this is the real. And at that point, I got my first TV series. It was a show called Fame, based on the movie. It's a weekly show. And they were taking a chance because I had not done TV, but they needed people to shake them up. So I watched a couple of their episodes, and I didn't much like them. I thought they were slow, and I thought, show tunes, give me a break. I didn't know the role of a director in a TV series. I was only knew the role of director making a movie. So I may get crazy already. So if I want music for a scene, I bring in the music, go, we're going to do this. So we have this music meeting, and Debbie Allen's in charge of dance and music and everything. And this is my first day, and I'm already a little outside the box of what they want. But they've written this episode because they liked Rock and Roll High School so much. And they wrote this very strange breaking the fourth wall episode with science fiction dance numbers in it. And the first dance number is like these robots dancing. And so I said, starting out politely, Debbie, I mean, everyone, what kind of music do you think we should have for this? And I say, hey, I'm the director. I said, how about Afrika Bambaataa's Planet Rock? Everybody turns to me and Debbie looks at me and goes, who are you? And I said, you know this, don't you? Assuming because she's black, she must. She goes,
yeah.
Yeah, and why would this guy? I said, because it's got those space age sounds. It's working with that Kraftwerk thing, you know.
Exactly.
And,
yeah.
And we're doing the science fiction, so they can do the breakdance thing and do something modern. And she goes, okay.
Let's skip the rest of the favorites. We've got a couple of Iggy records. Yeah. Man, did you tease me, because I really thought you were not joking when you pulled out Metal Machine Music and said it's your favorite Lou record. And I was so excited. I do love The Blue Mask. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. My favorite Lou song could be Women, especially Quine's guitar solo. His guitar work in that is heartbreaking to me.
Blue Mask is how I got Lou in Get Crazy.
Okay.
I wanted Lou Reed because obviously I couldn't get Dylan, but I wanted someone to play the Dylan character. And since I loved Lou Reed's music, we called up his management and they said, yeah, well, meet with Lou. Why don't you have lunch with Lou? So we flew to New York and had lunch with Lou. He was asking me a lot of questions. And I said, you know, Velvet Underground, I could tell you how much I liked all those records and stuff. But what I find so great about your work is that you're getting better. And he looked at me because everyone wants to talk about Walk on the Wild Side. You know? And I said, the Blue Mask is profound.
It really is.
The way that you deal with the present, you're confronting death, you're confronting aging, you're confronting being mugged in New York. And the sound of that guitar during the mugging is unbelievable. And he said yes to the movie based on my passion for Blue Mask.
That's great. You got to know which record to drop with people. I'd have to go with Berlin just because I'm a sad sack piece of shit.
Because we're having this convoluted conversation, one of the three women who made up Riff Randall did a term paper at City College of New York about Berlin.
That's awesome.
How much do you like this person now?
You know, my favorite thing about that record is you've heard the record many times, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so in the track The Kids, in order to get the sound of the kids crying in the background, the producer, Bob Ezrin, made his fucking kids cry and then dropped a mic on them.
Ah. Also, Filling You Up With Pills, that song, there's a long drum intro in it that kind of pulls you in because you're waiting for something else.
It goes, that one?
Yeah.
Love that. All Your Two-Bit Friends.
I like the album where he says, this is your last shot, you know, and he describes ODing. Legendary Hearts. There are bands where it's like you're getting in a car and you're going down a road at night. And all of a sudden, you're going way too fast and around corners. And you're barely hanging on. And everyone's going, ah, screaming along with the records. And the driver turns off the lights. That's rock and roll. Because if you make it to the bottom, you're alive.
All right, that about does it. A heartfelt Discography thanks goes out to our graphic designer, Todd Zimmer, my beautiful wife and son, Jen and Mason, Alan Arkish, my incredibly loyal fans, and especially the entire Patreon community. I love you, and this show would not exist without you, my friends. Speaking of friends, it's high time for some new ones. They're in our Facebook group, Discography Soldiers of Sound. That's the best way to find out what's coming up on the show, but there's a hell of a lot more. You get recaps of the day in music history, the ability to pitch questions to guests, polls that put you in the driver's seat on guest and band decisions, access to a thriving creative hub if you're looking for a collaborator, and much more. So make sure you don't miss out. You can find the link to the Discography Soldiers of Sound Facebook page right there in the show notes. And if you don't mess with the Zuck, hey, no sweat. Just email me at info@discography.com and I'll keep you in the loop. So now that it's done and you want more, another way to dive even deeper is to head straight to the John Landis series, episodes 85 through 93, in which we talk about the legendary director's entire career, stopping to discuss the great contributions he's made to the evolution of music and film. But wait just a minute. This is just the entrance to the rabbit hole. Join us as we descend down, down, down on Discography's triple episode, The Week of Lists Deep Dive. Of course, if you're a Patreon subscriber, then you already know to keep your ears peeled throughout the week, because this Monday brings the Patreon-only wildcard episode, Bonus Arkish, wherein, as per usual, only the choicest cuts are served up. Not to mention Wednesday's incredible Patreon-only episode of Discography's The Private Press, which is a very special Paul Majors Top 10 Private Press Albums of All Time. Make sure you visit patreon.com/discography and check out the deep dive as a music obsessive's way of life. Every week is a new thematically linked triple episode deep dive trawl. You're going to love it. And of course, be sure to mark your calendars, because next Friday, July 7th, we're coming at you with Vashti Bunyan, who, believe it or not, has consented with yours truly to go through her entire catalog, every single song, and rate every last thing she's done from 0 to 5 stars. Holy shit, right? Yeah, holy shit. And so, from now till then, don't let our youth go to waste, lads and ladies. It's Discography.